From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, the distinctions between racial inequality, racial disparities, and racism. Plus, season four of the locally produced PBS series Pioneers of Television premieres this week. Producer Mike Trinkline talks about the enduring appeal of the show's subjects.
These people kind of are our royalty of American culture in a way, and it's always kind of fun to revisit those memories that we've had and kind of see why they were funny and why they kept us interested way back.
And photographer Brian Ulrich tries to wrap his arms and his lens around a massive subject, consumerism.
How do you get people to pay attention to this thing which is in our periphery? How do you get people to think about this subject which is big, which is encompassing, and which is representative of so much?
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. For the past several months, Lake Effect and WUWM News have been examining the high rate of African-American male incarceration in the Milwaukee area. We've looked at the impact on both the Black and the broader community, and in the coming weeks, we'll look towards solutions to the issue. We've also discussed some of the myriad causes of the problem, and some have spoken about what they see as racially discriminatory practices at several levels. While some lump that concept in under the umbrella term racism, our first guest this morning would urge you to understand the distinctions between the two concepts. Dr. Imani Perry is professor at Princeton University's Center for African American Studies. She was one of Marquette University's three Metcalf chairs this semester and talked about the persistence of racial inequality last week in Milwaukee. She joined us in the studio as well. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
One of the key points, maybe the key point you make in your work, is that despite the fact that racism as maybe an overt act is not as prevalent in this country as it once was, racial discrimination and inequality still persists. What are you getting at? What do you mean by that, and how is it most evident?
Sure. So one of the things that sort of guided the entire project is this reality that, on the one hand, we're a country that since the mid-60s has proclaimed a commitment to equality, to egalitarianism, and I do think that that virtue is held sincerely. At the same time, we see not just deep inequality along the lines of race, but also what I call practices of inequality. So I get to that by looking at research in economics and sociology and political science and neuroscience and all of these different fields. And what you see is there are patterns where people disadvantage others on the basis of race. And so the prevalence of these patterns is really extraordinary. And so I tried to puzzle through, how does this happen? How is there such a disjuncture between our stated values and our practices? How do we learn this behavior? And I really come to the conclusion that this is not how we think about, we conventionally think about racism as like animus, right? I don't like this person because of who they are. It's not that so much as it is the ways we're socialized to see other people. This happens through popular narratives about different groups. This happens through the way that we organize society and the kind of categories that we place people into. This happens through the kind of spaces we see people occupying, like kind of geographies, neighborhoods, and the like. And so I wanted to talk about how to understand racial inequality as a cultural practice, and then to think about how do we begin to undo those cultural practices.
Well, what are some of those popular narratives that you talk about that maybe are common, but people who aren't paying attention don't realize that that's what these narratives are about?
Right. So I think that's a great question. So for example, things like African Americans don't value education or don't want to work or have been so damaged by the history of racism that they are unwilling to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Those, and I think it's important to say, those narratives are not held by members of one political party or another, and not necessarily held by groups of members of a particular racial group. I mean, I think they're sort of when I say it's part of American culture, it's pervasive. So it's not a kind of one-way thing. It's the way – so that you even have people within that group believing those narratives. It's just always not them. It's somebody else, right? who has a – and so I think it's just – it's an indication. And part of why this happens is because, you know, we look at the world around us. We see that different people tend to live in different places, to occupy different locations in our society, and we don't understand why.
I was just going to ask, right. if we're just not asking why.
We're not asking why, and so part of what our brains do is we fill in the gaps to explain what we see. We tell stories, and we repeat stories. So, for example, when I teach my students, when I ask my students, why do you think there's a racial wealth gap before they have been through a semester of my class? And they often think, well, different rates of savings or different commitments to homeownership and the like. And then when I tell them, well, in fact, in the 20th century, the mid-20th century, the federal government had discriminatory policies that led to differences in home ownership rates and values of homes, right? And so I think that's – now, these are students who are not presuming any inferiority. They just don't know, right? And so part of this, I talk in the book about shifting our narratives, is to tell a fuller story in order to undo the way racial narratives guide our behavior.
Would you contend that the getting past the intentional part of racism was maybe the easy part? Not that it went quickly, but in some ways it seems like shifting that sort of straight ahead, I don't like people because of the color of their skin, is a much easier thing to wrap your head around than this post-intentional racism.
I think – right. I think it is something that's easier to wrap one's head around, although it places us in this bizarre conundrum. So there was – when people saw inequality and racial bigotry was a norm, then it was easy to understand what was going on. When the average American is walking around saying, I don't believe in racial inequality, and trying to make sense of this society that is unequal, and then feeling deeply uncomfortable about talking about race, right? It makes a really difficult kind of, you know, soup of things that we're having to deal with. So this is the harder part, but it's also difficult because there was so much unfinished business after the Civil Rights Revolution. And so it's not entirely surprising that this is where we are at this point.
I wonder if part of the issue is that for many white people, they hear the phrase racial discrimination and they say, well, that can't be because I'm not a racist.
Right. And I think the problem is the label racist forecloses so much conversation, right? And so – and I almost think we live in a moment where there is more anxiety about being labeled a racist than there is about racial inequality. And so when I talk about practices of inequality, I'm not talking about what we mean generally when we say someone is a racist, a feeling of animus. But the reality is that I, as an African-American woman, if I go to purchase a car, I am more likely to pay more. Right. I don't think that the person is looking at me and saying, I want this black person to pay more. But I do think that something is happening about the sense of identification or disidentification with me as a buyer that leads me to have to pay more. Or, you know, it happens in housing or in medical care, you know. So you see doctors much less likely to order more extensive testing for African Americans. Some of that is even related to this idea that African Americans are less likely to be compliant with respect to taking medication. That's true, but the question should be not – the answer is not to deny treatment, but rather to say, well, why are they less likely to be compliant? And so I think, you know, it's – practices of inequality don't require any conscious animus. What they depend upon, though, is ways of seeing people and how we tell stories based upon what we see when we look at someone.
Well, and so let's take those couple of examples, say the practice of inequality in medical care or the practice of inequality in terms of buying a house or a car. How do we start to unpack those and push the needle back towards equality in cases like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are many ways to approach this. So one way is to – and this is the way that sometimes people have done this in medicine – is actually create more stringent standards of care, period, right? So that everybody who we see having these set of symptoms has to have these types of outcomes so that there's not the space for the exercise of discretion. It's difficult to say we want to get rid of discretion. On the one hand, discretion helps us work with some kind of nuance. You know, different situations are different, right? Do we want everything so tightly regulated? On the other hand, it's where there is discretion is where we see practices of inequality occurring. They occur across lines of political difference, across lines of ethnic difference. And so one response is to have a sort of a higher level of standards of care. Another kind of response, which is a broader cultural response, is to begin to be more explicit about these about this evidence, right? One of the things that a lot of social cognition research shows is that when people become aware that certain behaviors are associated with racial inequality, they are more capable of self-correcting. And so if you say, oh, this is the kind of thing where you all where discrimination always happens, then it gives people information that enables them to watch themselves and make sure that they're acting in a fair fashion. And so the bizarre thing is that, you know, because it's so impolite to talk about race in this country, then we don't give ourselves the opportunity to do that.
Well, and it sounds like the conversation you're hoping takes place, or the new narrative, if you will, is one that isn't necessarily accusatory. It's just putting this on people's radar screens.
Exactly. I mean, I think the problem and this is a problem for in terms of what happened in constitutional law. We began to identify racial inequality in terms of individual actions, bad actors. And that's a problem because race is a cultural and social phenomenon. It is not individual. It has, you know, the only way that we can see these patterns is in accumulation. In each individual case, you can probably find a reason for a multitude of potential reasons that any person made a decision, right? So you can't rely upon saying this action was racist, right? What you have to do is create safeguards and ways of reshaping how people talk and think about things that enable – that reduce the accumulation or the patterns as opposed to focusing on the individual actor.
The situation currently exists. We at this radio station actually have spent the last few months looking into the issue of the high rates of African-American male incarceration in Milwaukee County. And I'm curious to get your take on how this dynamic plays into that equation. I mean, the narrative tends to go along the lines of, at one level, there's a group of people that point to the fact that so many African-American males are incarcerated. And then on the other side, you have people saying, well, African-Americans are also disproportionately victims of crimes.
That's right.
And so I guess if you were to take your look at transcending racial inequality in this context, how would you start to unpack that situation, if you will?
That's a great question. I mean, one of the things that I immediately turn to is that at every stage of the process of law enforcement, there's evidence of the practices of inequality. So rates of stop, right, the decision to pursue a case, what the person is going to be charged with. And it doesn't just fall along lines of race where in like circumstances, African-American defendants tend to be treated more harshly, right, from arrest to conviction. But it also has to do with color. So darker-skinned African-Americans are much more likely to be convicted with longer sentences than lighter-skinned African-Americans. So once we know that, right, that to me occasions something that we need to actually sound some alarm bells over, particularly given that the rate of incarceration is so astronomical in the United States and that felony conviction really kind of disables people for the rest of their lives in terms of employment and in terms of being productive members of the society, right? I would add that the rates of incarceration have gone up dramatically. Now they're just starting to dip, but they've gone up dramatically even as crime has been reduced, right? So I would want to I would advocate taking approaches that are actually – that is as opposed to the kind of tough-on-crime law and order response, which has coincided so tightly with practices of racial inequality, to think strategically and carefully about how do we reduce crime, right? And that has a lot to do with employment, right? That has a lot to do with various kinds of social services, as opposed to a response that is carceral, because a carceral response is just in some ways just triggers practices of inequality in ways that are particularly pernicious.
Well, and in this case, would you say more discretion is better?
More discretion is absolutely not better, because the more discretion there is, we found even with both juries and judges, the more discretion there is more discrimination. Now, discretion, on the other hand, though, with respect to not having mandatory sentences is productive, because mandatory sentences have been, you know, have just increased incarceration just exponentially. But we do want to have some pressure to treat like cases in like fashion. And also the incentive structure for prosecutors, right, to pursue a higher conviction rate is deeply problematic, right? over 90% of cases never go to trial, right? The plea bargaining system is broken. People don't get their day in court. So there's all these procedural matters that are also fueling this kind of deep inequality and crisis of mass incarceration.
Your book on the subject, More Beautiful and More Terrible, came out 3 years ago, I think, in the midst of President Obama's first term in office. And when Barack Obama was elected, there were all these discussions about whether we are living in the post-racial society. And that almost seems like a quaint storyline in 2014.
Right.
There's plenty of evidence that we are not in a post-racial society. Do you think there's been any progress at all in terms of achieving racial equality? Has the Obama administration to this point or these Obama years had any legacy in terms of moving the needle?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there's some sort of modest emotional impact that comes from, you know, it is a big transition to imagine the leader of the United States and what people call the leader of the free world as a person of African descent. That's a dramatic shift. But in terms of the lives of African Americans generally, absolutely not at all. And in point of fact, these have been the years of the greatest economic devastation in the past 40 years. So that the impact of the subprime mortgage lending crisis has basically halved the relative wealth of African Americans, and it's also devastated the wealth of Latinos. And these are years of the incredibly devastating impact of high rates of deportation. And so we have to get beyond the thinking of race in symbolic terms. In fact, in a somewhat prophetic moment, the first title of this book was The First Black President. That was before Obama announced his run. And part of the idea was I was going to say we could have the first black president without shifting anything about racial inequality in this country. That title didn't stick, but I think I anticipated what was going to happen, right? We have these exceptional figures who can transcend everything, and yet people, the large groups, are not necessarily impacted by that.
Well, Imani Perry, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Imani Perry is professor at Princeton University's Center for African American Studies and faculty associate in Princeton's program in law and public affairs. She was one of Marquette University's three Ralph Metcalf chairs during this semester and spoke last week on the Milwaukee campus. Season 4 of the show Pioneers of Television premieres tomorrow on PBS with an episode on stand-up comedians who went on to successful sitcoms. It's the work of two Milwaukee film producers. We'll chat with Mike Trinkline about the upcoming season when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Maybe it's an obvious point, but stand-up comedians, they're generally pretty funny people to be around. But does a solid stand-up act necessarily translate to a funny sitcom? Not always. Some of the most successful stand-ups to make the leap are featured tomorrow night in the first episode of the fourth season of the public TV series Pioneers of Television. The series is produced by two local film producers, Steve Betcher and Mike Trinkline. Mike Trinkline joins us in the studio ahead of the season premiere. Welcome back to Lake Effect.
Great to be here.
Great to have you back. This is the fourth season of Pioneers of Television, and it appears you have really not run short of material.
No, there's always lots of good things to talk about with television. I think these people kind of are our royalty of American culture in a way, and it's always kind of fun to revisit those memories that we've had and kind of see why they were funny and why they kept us interested way back.
I feel like I'm interviewing the Ken Burns of old TV shows.
Well, they haven't. Yeah, I don't think so. Ken has his own category. And in fact, the great thing about Ken Burns is we're in the honored position of being the lead-in for his next show on the Gettysburg Address. So we, on Tuesday night, we are first and he is second.
The season opens with a show on stand-up comics who went on to have shows built around them. You make reference to some of the earliest ones like George Burns and Gracie Allen, for example. But really, in terms of the modern sitcom, the first one to really try to harness a stand-up's personality was really the Bob Newhart Show.
Yeah, there was this long gap when stand-ups didn't do sitcoms very much at all, and Bob Newhart sort of stumbled into it. He had been a very successful comedian long before he did his first sitcom show. He actually knocked Elvis out of number one.
That amazed me, yeah.
Number one record, yeah. And he's just a fascinating story. Of course, he's from Chicago, and he actually was an accountant and almost gave up on comedy because he couldn't really get any traction. And then finally his comedy album got released, and he was just went from nothing to a huge thousands of people coming to his concerts all at once. So, but that was long before he got into the sitcom.
Well, and that was, I think, one of the interesting things that we learn is that when he made that comedy album, he really didn't have much experience in front of a large audience at all.
No, they wanted to record him in front of a live audience for the comedy album, and he said he had never done it. And so they had to find a place for him to actually do it in front of an audience. And yeah, it's a kind of an interesting story. So that's when he did the sitcom. Then he wanted to create a character that reacted to other people, sort of like he did in his comedy routines. He's always sort of on the phone reacting. That's what he does well. And my favorite anecdote was at one point in the Bob Newhart show, his first sitcom, they wanted him to go a little faster. And he said, you know, this stammer got me home in Beverly Hills. I'm not going to change it.
Right. And we learned that the stammer was not an affectation. That's just the way he talks.
No, it's exactly how he talks. In fact, we had him at an event not long ago in Los Angeles promoting the show, and even with an audience, that's exactly his cadence, and he couldn't change it if he wanted to.
As that show was being developed, we also learned that originally they wanted him to be a psychiatrist. It seems like a subtle difference that he ended up being a psychologist, but he really kind of explained why that was.
Well, yeah, a psychiatrist is dealing with really more serious problems. But one thing that came out of the interview was he said he kind of has a very dark sense of humor. He's kind of got a very macabre idea behind him in terms of his comedy. But that was not part of the show. He didn't think that would quite work on television.
The guy you opened the show with, essentially, Jerry Seinfeld, I was struck by how gee whiz he was about the whole experience. Even to this day, he sounded maybe pleasantly surprised about how well it went.
Yeah, I don't think he had a big plan of that he wanted to do a sitcom. He was very happy doing stand-up. And in fact, now you can tell he's returned to stand-up because that's really where his roots are. That's really what he enjoys doing. So the sitcom was kind of a pleasant diversion. And in fact, he talks about in the show that he didn't really have any ideas. And it was really Larry David who said, hey, let's do this and this and this. And Jerry said, okay, and kind of fell into it from there.
And he also explained why he doesn't want to go back and do another necessarily.
Yeah, I think he can't really top it. I think plus it's a lot of work, and he makes the point in the show that I think all the stand-ups, this is true for them, and that is that when you're doing stand-up, you work alone. It's probably the most solitary art form there is. And when you're doing a sitcom, you're running a corporation, and it's very hard to make that transition, which is why there's not a long list of people who've done it, because you have to be able to have your voice amplified in the show but not be taken over by others. And there have been a number of stand-up stars who've not done well in the sitcom form. A good example would be, say, a Phyllis Diller, who actually had a sitcom and it failed because she told us that it just didn't really reflect her stand-up persona. And the successful sitcoms are the ones that reflect the persona of the stand-up artist. And Jerry Seinfeld's did, Tim Allen's did, Roseanne Barr's did.
Well, and one of the recurrent experiences that several of these stand-up comics reported was that their respective networks offered or practically demanded that they work with an acting coach.
Yeah. It's kind of funny. I think the networks are all very scared that these stand-up people couldn't really do it. In fact, Tim Allen talks about how, they made him go to a coach so he could, to see if he could actually memorize, He's like, yeah, I can do that. I'm pretty good at that. So, yeah, it is interesting that it took a while for the networks to really warm up to the idea that stand-up people could really make it in a sitcom, and they obviously have done very well.
Of all of them, Ray Romano was kind of the least interested in doing a sitcom in general, right?
Well, I think if you're a stand-up in the back of your mind, you imagine a sitcom. But I think what we often forget is that a lot of these people had very successful careers before they had stand-ups. Ray Romano was doing just fine. Tim Allen was doing great. So was Jerry Seinfeld. They didn't need a sitcom to earn a living. They weren't destitute. So, they kind of took it as it came and were happy to do it, but it wasn't something they had to do.
To a person, all of them, Tim Allen, I think Jerry Seinfeld, Ray Romano, and Roseanne Barr, they all talked about their big break being the idea of going on The Tonight Show with Carson as host. Of all of them, how was Tim Allen's experience different?
Well, he talks about it in the show. He totally bombed. And one of the great things about what we can do in Pioneers of Television is we can actually take him talking about how he bombed, and then we can actually see it. There are a number of segments of the show where we can actually kind of put these things side by side, because it's one thing for Tim Allen to say, I was terrible. And then when you could actually watch what he did, and he actually was not that bad, although apparently he thought he was bad. And it's just kind of fun to see them talk about this great moment in their lives, this sort of apex of their career, and then be able to see it firsthand. It's kind of a fun experience.
Well, and easier for them to talk about it now than it probably was right after it happened. They've all gone on to some pretty good things.
Yeah, I mean, I think they all sort of saw that as kind of the watershed, and then, you know, life goes on from there. But once you've reached the top of the mountain, you know, you feel good about yourself.
Do you think the appearances on The Tonight Show or any of the late-night talk shows are as big a deal today as they were when these guys were coming up?
Oh, I think clearly not. I mean, I think at that time it was Johnny Carson and that was it. And now we have 3, 4, 5 great shows coming on. And, of course, the lineup is changing. Jimmy Fallon is doing fantastic. And but the interesting is those shows don't often have comedians. And it's interesting why. Jay Leno told us this when we interviewed him, and that is that they don't keep the audience there. I mean, I love the comedians, but interestingly, we want to see celebrities as opposed to unknown comedians. And so a lot of the shows have shied away from stand-up comics, and that's kind of hurt the whole progression that this episode talks about.
Well, let's talk briefly about some of the other episodes. There is another one, I think it's the second one of the season, on doctors and nurses, people on medical dramas. And at one point, there's a reference to how some of these shows, you know, we think of them as life or death drama, but they're also groundbreaking shows. What was the new ground that was really broken on programs like, you know, like ER, St. Elsewhere, and others?
Well, I think in one sense, they really wanted realism. And a lot of medical shows back in the 50s and 60s weren't terribly realistic. In fact, you know, doctors would kind of laugh at them at how unrealistic they were. So when you had a show like ER or St. Elsewhere before it, they would use the language that doctors would use, knowing full well we didn't know what they were talking about.
I think Howie Mandel makes the point he didn't know what they were talking about.
No idea. Yeah, Howie Mandel on St. Elsewhere. Yeah, it's so funny because he tells a story that's remarkably parallel to one Noah Wiley tells, where they can rattle off this incredible medical jargon, have no idea what it means, but now 20 years later they can still, it's so burned into their memory what these lines are, you know. I won't even try to do it, but it's very funny in the show.
I believe we've actually had Alan Alda on this show, and he talked about the same thing, you know. There was a lot of 3-0 silk going on in MASH.
Yeah, it is kind of funny. And in fact, at one point in the show we have Noah Wiley today split screen with Noah Wiley from the show doing exactly the same, you know, 40 seconds of dialogue. And it's so funny because the pace and the cadence is even identical. It isn't just he knows the words still. He can actually deliver it in the same way he did on the show.
The other thing that strikes me about some of the medical medical shows that you spotlight, some of the actors in these shows have really used those shows as launching points for enormous careers.
Well, yeah. I mean, the most obvious one, of course, is George Clooney, who's now, you know, the number one movie star. And we kind of talk about how he was making that transition, doing movies while he was actually doing ER. In fact, one trick he would do is to actually write the script lines on the pillowcases. And in fact, we actually found a clip from the show where they didn't really pay close attention. You can actually see the line he's reading, you know, right off the pillow, off the dying child. He's saying, you know, those lines that are on the script are right on the pillow.
There's another episode in the series called Acting Funny. How do you distinguish that episode from the first one on stand-up comedians? I mean, there are people who acted funny on shows who also had stand-up careers.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're doing in the Acting Funny episode is just trying to talk about the different approaches people take to acting on television and in television comedy. There are those who are more improv artists like a Robin Williams or a Jonathan Winters. There are more method actors like a Cloris Leachman. There are some of physical comedians like a Dick Van Dyke. And then there's this new idea, the sort of more writer-centric actor like a Tina Fey, who really wants to focus on the written word as really where the comedy comes from. And they each are remarkably different. And when you see them side by side, it's kind of fascinating to see how each works. I mean, the contrast would be, for example, where a Tina Fey, we'll talk about in the episode, how important it is to get every word right because she's written that script precisely. Contrast that with a Jonathan Winters, who hated writers, didn't like anything written for him, wanted to improv his way through an episode. And, you know, both are funny, but it's just very different approaches to the craft of acting funny.
Well, you also mentioned Robin Williams, and obviously Robin Williams has gone on to a really remarkable career. How does he view his time on, you know, what some people might think of as kind of a, if not throwaway, sitcom? It's kind of a, Mork and Mindy is not necessarily in the popular culture today.
It was fun. I mean, he had fun, and I think that was his way to kind of break through the audience. I think you could tell by the third or fourth season the show didn't have new ideas. They brought Jonathan Winters on, and he gave it some new life. But I think it's the kind of thing where it's a rite of passage, like kind of like going to college. You know, 4 years is good, but 5 or 6 years is too many. And I think that's how he sort of felt about that show. And what's interesting about him and a lot of people that we interviewed is that he really didn't set out to be a comedian. He wanted to be a serious actor. He went to Juilliard, for example. And even Jerry Seinfeld actually started out going to acting classes and wanted to be an actor. Joan Rivers wanted to be an actress. It's just kind of funny how we think of people in certain roles, but when they were young, they thought of themselves differently.
The other episode in the fourth season is on breaking barriers, and this seems to take season three's show about women in comedy one step further.
Yeah, we're basically talking about people of color on television and sort of the standouts and the struggles that they've had in that process. So whether it's Bill Cosby or Diane Carroll or even someone like George Takei or someone like Edward James Olmos, who had this kind of fascinating story to tell. And he's really the first Latino to have kind of a sort of an executive role on a television show where he actually, you know, had a character who had some authority. And in Miami Vice, of course, the show where he first came to fame, he was sort of the captain. Another actor had played that role before him, and that actor had never gotten much respect from Don Johnson's character, so he quit. So Edward James Olmos comes in, and he decides he's going to show he has authority. And he basically, if you watch the first episodes of Miami Vice, he never looks at anybody. He talks to the wall. He explained this in the episode. He said, I wasn't going to show them any respect. I was going to talk to the wall. And we put that together with actual clips. And sure enough, on Miami Vice, that's all he does is just talk to the wall. It's hilarious. But it shows that he wanted authority for his character and he was going to have respect whether they gave it to him or not.
Well, what's interesting about this is, these are fictional characters. These are characters that were created. But the actors were actually trying to do something with them beyond the lines on the page in front of them.
Well, that's a very good insight, Mitch, because I think it shows what's true of everybody in this episode of Breaking Barriers, that all these actors really had something to say beyond just what their characters were saying. They were trying to make a point about people of color in the media, that we're here and we're important and we have a role to play. And whether it was, you know, George Takei on Star Trek or whether it was even Margaret Cho. Margaret Cho's sitcom, All-American Girl, not well remembered, but still remains the only sitcom on television with an Asian-American family. I mean, you know, we still have problems in TV getting a broad diversity of Americans on these shows.
Which is funny because when you think about it, there have been several sitcoms that have come to network TV about aliens.
Yeah, there are more aliens than blacks or Asians on television. Yeah, that's kind of the unfortunate truth is that we don't have a good representation. In fact, what a lot of people talked about in this episode is how you have kind of the African-American or the Asian-American is kind of the sidekick. They're always sort of that secondary role. And it's a challenge for American television, yeah.
Always interesting stuff. Mike Trinkline, thanks so much. Congratulations on another season.
Thank you very much, Mitch. It was fun.
Mike Trinkline is a writer and one of the producers of Pioneers of Television. The fourth season of the series premieres tomorrow evening on PBS. Trinkline lives in Cedarburg. Milwaukee producer Steve Betcher also directed and co-produced the series. One last break, and then a photography exhibit at the Hagerty Museum leads us to think about our roles as consumers. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich, and it's time for our weekly series, The Islands of Milwaukee.
Welcome to the Islands of Milwaukee.
This is Maureen Towie from the Islands of Milwaukee. For the folks that we're working with who are living at home alone and maybe receiving some assistance, it's not unusual to hear that they're over 85. But for the support staff we're working with, we're not used to hearing...
I'm a senior citizen.
That's Bob, one of the meal delivery drivers.
Oh, my name is Robert Whiteside. Everybody call me Bob. And I'm about the oldest person around here. I'm only 91 years old. And still, my wife asked me, Well, I'm gonna quit doing this job, and I tell her, "Well, I'm scared to quit. So I'm doing so well doing it. So I said, if I quit doing it, I might get stiff and stow up and can't move. Now I can walk. I don't need a cane, and I don't need a walker. And I'm 91, can still move good."
Bob has so many great stories about the people he delivers meals to. He loves to help them out and to joke with them.
I had a guy, he didn't have no legs. Both his legs had been amputated. And I used to go to the door and knock on the door. The name of Joe was, "Hey, Joe, come running." Boy, he laughed. Boy, I wished I could come running. You know, I joke with them like that. You know, I'm still a pit and they like that.
Like many of the drivers, Bob feels connected to his clients.
You go on, you know, after you start, you enjoy helping people. Some of the people you help is handicapped. And then you get acquainted with them and be just like a family, you know. You be looking to see, you every day, and you looking to see them. And when they sick something, then you worry about their condition.
We're finding examples like this all over Milwaukee, of older adults helping other older adults, Bob and other seniors who still have a lot to give. If you know of an older adult living alone who might be interested in answering some of our questions of the day, please call our Islands line or visit our website. We would love to hear from you. Seniors, junior seniors, super seniors, and people who do not want to be called seniors are all welcome to the Islands of Milwaukee. Thanks for listening.
You can participate in the Islands of Milwaukee project by calling the Islands hotline at 414-678-1653 or by visiting islandsofmilwaukee.org. Marquette University's Hagerty Museum of Art is host to a major exhibit of photography that makes us look at and question what it means to be a consumer. For 10 years, American photographer Brian Ulrich traveled across the United States to document Americans shopping. The exhibit is in three chapters: retail store, thrift shops, and dark or closed stores. Ulrich is based in Virginia now, but started the project as a graduate student at Columbia College in Chicago in 2001. Speaking back in February, he told Lake Effect's Bonnie North what started him on this path.
It was a number of things, but most of all, I started graduate school in Chicago at Columbia College in 2001, and our first day of graduate school was September 11th. And that whole event, of course, had such an impact on us, the culture, the world. You know, there's kind of before and after as a result. But it had this really big impact on me as a person, as an artist. And I had previously been doing kind of autobiographical work. And I realized right then and there that I kind of really wanted to explore the culture and the world and look at this moment and look at how people were dealing with it. You know, there was this amazing kind of grieving process that was happening where people, the whole kind of societal norms and cultural rules were broken down, and people were really kind of comforting each other. And it was mostly because, you know, this is what happened when tragedy happens, but here it happened to the whole culture and the whole country. And so people were pulling together in these amazing and beautiful ways. And I was really just in the beginning trying to photograph that, ironically enough. I was trying to make pictures of that happening kind of naturally. So I started making photographs out on the street and in public places where, you know, those kind of moments or those kind of relationships between peoples might come together. And when I started to figure out ways to do that or some strategies to do that, all of a sudden the kind of messaging that was happening or the conversation about this post kind of 9/11 grieving changed pretty radically, and it started changing into this messaging about kind of fear, you know, about like this can happen again. We're all of a sudden extremely unsafe. We should be worried. We have to do things to prepare. And one of these ways in which people talked about preparing was to, you know, and originally it was Giuliani, and later it was Dick Cheney and President Bush and a number of other politicians who came out and basically started asking citizens to go out and shop. And of course, they were really worried about the economic hit that was going to happen to the country, but also this idea of kind of back to normal I thought that was very, very kind of weird and interesting and powerful and complex and problematic. And
do you remember how quickly that happened, that changed from that, sort of communal grieving to go out and buy?
It happened pretty quickly. Those first kind of sentiments started coming, the kind of like worry stuff was really kind of October. That kind of idea of economics, right, that was also really soon after, where Giuliani was kind of saying, like, you know, we need to go about our regular lives. And in that context, of course, it made a lot of sense. But that kind of meme or idea was picked up on and continued up into 2002, when people were kind of talking about this idea and, like, economically what we needed to do and how we needed to reinforce ourselves. And, you know, I just thought that was really interesting in the history of wars and the history of our country and the history of people and man, where this idea of money being all of a sudden the kind of protecting thing and the thing that is so connected to what will make it okay. I really just initially wanted to see if people were doing that. Like, would people follow this directive to go out and kind of patriotic shop? Was shopping now like patriotic? Was it like Cheerios were like red, white, and blue? And I answered that question pretty quickly, which was, yeah, people were. People did go out. And there was this kind of idea that, you know, this was a way in which people felt like they could, of course, participate and contribute and be a part of supporting our country, which is, of course, a very important thing. But within that, within trying to make some pictures of that, it again dawned on me that what I was starting to look at was something that was much, much bigger, that was really only could happen now, really was the dawn of the 21st century and was ideas that had been set in motion decades earlier. And it was kind of a daunting feeling, but it was also a very exciting thing, which was I had to kind of get to work and figure out a way to do this. So initially that idea manifested itself in really looking at middle class experience of this and middle class relationship to consumerism. And that is in this kind of chapter of this larger Copia project, and it's called Retail, pretty simply.
There are three parts to this. The first one is retail, then you have thrift, and then you have the dark store, sort of the, you know, the mm-hmm. The very end of consumerism before it kind of gets recycled into something else. Did you start out with those in mind, or did those evolve as you progressed in the initial photographs?
You know, what was, again, at times daunting and in other ways many very liberating was the idea that I wasn't necessarily in a hurry to do this project, that it didn't have a deadline, that it didn't have to have a completion date. Really, it was about trying to figure out ways to make the next picture. And with that came a lot of research, too. And those two things working tandem started to take me to places that, of course, were kind of outside of what I had already thought or knew or expected. So I didn't really plan to do thrift. In fact, I remember bringing that idea up early on to some professors. And they were like, oh, that sounds like a great idea. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. That's just too much more work, you know. It's like a whole other amount of traveling and things that has to happen. But then in 2005, Hurricane Katrina happened. And all of a sudden, it really seemed like a very succinct moment where the broadcast of such a large problem in this country, which is poverty and race, was broadcast on primetime TV, like 24-hour news, like over and over and over. And I started thinking about, like, well, wouldn't thrift then be the great way to talk about that? And again, not necessarily in the kind of obvious way of we buy and make too many things, but all the other parts, which are based around the tradition of these kind of resale shops and thrift stores being community organizations that are there in service to the community. And of course, in more recent times, poor people or people, you know, who economically have to, you know, shop in those places. So that became a whole other investigation, and it also asked me to make pictures in different ways than I had before.
And you're talking about the actual taking of the photographs in that sense? Okay. We'll talk about that in a minute. I want to get to Dark.
Yeah. The full title of that project is actually called Dark Stores, Ghost Boxes, and Dead Malls. And those terms are taken from the actual retail, especially retail real estate and commercial real estate industry uses those terms to describe specific spaces. They mean very specific things. You know, a dark store can be a store that's kind of laid dormant, but is maybe closed, but may come back. It's in this kind of like limbo place. A ghost box is like a store in which it's not coming back, and it's kind of the ghost of its former thing. And the, you know, and how amazing that these terms were invented. And of course, the dead mall represents, you know, the mall which is either failing or gone, and what to do with those things. So in 2005, I actually thought that would be the next project. But it was really came out of, I lived in Chicago at the time, and I used to drive past this large closed grocery store at night. And when I was driving past it at night, it looked specifically like a kind of Rothko painting. You know, I mean, there was the kind of gorgeous Chicago light pollution that is always happening where you can never see the night sky and it's always some color, you know, this kind of hulking square rectangle box that had been kind of painted and plywood covered on the front. And then the glimmering kind of night sky on the parking lot that was, and it was really divided into these three distinct forms, which, so I kind of thought, well, I have to try and see if it's possible to make a photograph that did what I think I'm seeing. So I went out one night and made a few pictures like that. And, you know, they were kind of almost there. But I immediately had this hard problem, which was like, how am I going to find more of those spaces? You know, how do you find all that stuff? And it was quite difficult because they weren't as predominant at the time. But I also remember writing early on that, like, that idea that this kind of model of always growth was really problematic, that for kind of retail business to always succeed, it had to always grow. And of course, there would be an inevitable conclusion to that, which would be that it would eventually have to recede, even in the idea that, like, nobody seemed to have seen that coming. It seemed so obvious to me. So when late 2007 and early 2008, the dialogue started happening around that, it seemed really obvious, and that seemed like the time to do that project, and it was. And I kind of made some pictures in earnest in May of 2008, and it was that, you know, those kind of moments where you know exactly what you need to do.
I find looking at the ones of the dark stores, you know, the ghost stores, it's very sad to see a building that was a house mm-hmm. that people no longer live in, that's abandoned. There's something very, very sort of aching and sad right. about that. There's a different feeling about the box stores because nobody ever lived in them, but there was a certain kind of life mm-hmm. that was there that is no more. And I don't know exactly what that feeling is. It's not, you're not mourning a family, Louise, but something's missing.
Yeah, I think the you know, I really specifically, again, even in the initial research, I came across those terms. Those terms were so kind of drippingly romantic that I thought it was really important to try to make the pictures as, like, drippingly romantic. Because they're very dumb spaces, in a sense. You know, we drive past them all the time. They're around us. They're outside the car window. And they're meant not to be looked at, which, of course, I find really interesting to make them this kind of specific subject of the photograph. So I would do all these things. That's why most of them were made at night. I would make these really long exposures, painting with flashlights. I got a police light that attached to the cigarette lighter on the car that reached really far, and I could kind of, like, expose the image over time. But I wanted that to do that because, again, the trick was to how do you get people to pay attention to this thing which is in our periphery? How do you get people to think about this subject which is big, which is encompassing, and which is representative of so much? I've had shows of that work and some of this work in Europe a few times, in Germany, and it's amazing how foreign the whole idea of much of this is. You know, like, they don't... I mean, I spent about half an hour trying to explain to a group of Germans what mall walking was, which was quite a hilarious and confusing and gratifying moment all at the same time. But the idea that there would be this much expansion and growth and building and investment and all this, and that it would be kind of left to literally kind of disintegrate back into the earth is so wild when you think about it.
Now, to just sort of sum up for you as the artist and the person doing all of this examination and exploration, have you changed your ideas about what material things mean, what consumerism means? Has it shifted over the last 10 years, or are you finding that the work you're doing is sort of reinforcing what you already suspected was there?
No, I think the one of the great things about, you know, it's in a sense, you know, it's, of course, it's not easy to be an artist, and it, of course, at times looks a lot more glamorous than it really is. But it is a real luxury to be able to work out an idea, a very kind of abstract thing that at times, as it's kind of being put together brick by brick, is hard to kind of even fathom, especially for other people. But the great part of that is that it teaches you, you know, and the project kind of leads you in all these interesting directions. So I can't ever be the same person after talking to some of the security guards whose jobs are basically inevitably over, who are guarding the dead mall in the parking lot at 2 a.m., or the cops who would come by to ask me what the hell I was doing. I can see how afraid they are to do their job. You can see the fear in them, and they're like, what are you doing? You realize where you are, you know? And so it's profound. I mean, you come into contact with so much of the way that people are living their lives, that of course it asks me to live differently. It asks me to redefine ideas of success. It asks me to redefine ideas of what I certainly need or want.
Well, Brian Ulrich, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with me. I really appreciate it. Best of luck with the exhibition.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
The exhibit, Brian Ulrich, Copia, Retail, Thrift, and Dark Stores, 2001 to 2011, is on display at the Hagerty Museum of Art through mid-May. Ulrich spoke with Bonnie North back in February. That's all for the Monday edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about colonoscopies, long-distance walking, and birdwatching in fiction, but not all in the same interview. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.